Rob Wolf, and welcome to episode number 75 of Unformidable, where we take a look at some of the less heralded Mets in our beloved franchise's quirky history, because to us, every player who dons the orange and blue is, in some way, unformidable. I apologize at the start for my long absence. My last pod, number 74, was tragic. We took a look back at the life and the untimely death of Pedro Feliciano. Unfortunately, I was away for a time dealing with a personally tragic issue as my stepfather recently passed away from cancer, and you know, was just dealing with that. And now, he was a Yankee fan, but we loved him anyway. In particular, he was a Yankees fan of a particular era in the 70s and the 80s, and he was of a particular background, being Italian. So I struggled a bit, but I finally found what I thought was some fitting common ground for he and I, given the general subject of this podcast, that being a local Italian lad, perhaps more known as a Yankee, but with a cameo year with the Mets as they tried unsuccessfully to hang on to the tail end of their 80s glory years, Mr. Rick Cerrone. Richard Aldo Cerrone was born May 19th, 1954, in Newark, New Jersey. He grew up in and around the tri-state area, primarily Jersey, where he attended Essex Catholic High School and eventually moved on to Seton Hall University, where he excelled in baseball and, from what I heard in discussing this podcast, may have known and perhaps made advances towards the mother of Amazing Avenue's own Brian Salvatore. And while Rick Cerrone might not have been able to catch her eye, he did catch the eye of baseball scouts. He was quite the college baseball star. He played on U.S. amateur teams in 1973 and 1974 before being drafted in the first round, seventh overall pick by the Cleveland Indians in 1975. I can't imagine we would see this nowadays with a catcher, or pretty much any prospect, but at age 21, the 7th overall pick reported to AAA for the Indians, and after only 46 games, made his Major League Baseball debut the year he was drafted. I mean, you don't hear many players doing that, I can't imagine that with a catcher. But at any rate, Rick Cerrone's first professional game was August 17th, 1975. He was inserted into a blowout, technically taking the lineup spot of the great Boog Powell. Cerrone went into catcher, Alan Ashby went to first, and Cerrone caught the last two innings of noted wife swapper Fritz Peterson's 16-hit complete game in a 14-5 Cleveland win. He got his first career plate appearance and lined out to shortstop in that game. His first professional hit would come 5 days later, in his first professional start, a single to left off of Kansas City's Paul Splittorff. But overall, he would appear in only 7 games in 1975, and would pretty much repeat that in 1976. He spent most of that season in AAA, but did get called up very briefly and appeared in 7 more Major League games for Cleveland, which would be all the games that he would play with the organization that drafted him. That offseason, Cerrone would be included in a deal to the expansion Toronto Blue Jays, who were getting ready to make their professional debut in 77. Cerrone and John Lowenstein went to Toronto in exchange for designated hitter Rico Carty on December 6, 1976. The fledgling franchise had also acquired the aforementioned Ashby from Cleveland in a separate deal, and hoped that the two young catchers would be potential building blocks for the franchise. Cerrone was now 23 and seemed to win the starting job out of spring training, or at least he won the honor of being the starting catcher in the Blue Jays' first game, and the first game in franchise history. Bill Singer threw the first regular season pitch in Toronto Blue Jays history in a light snow at Exhibition Stadium in pre-dome Toronto. And Rick Cerrone, on August 7, 1977, caught that first pitch in Blue Jays history. He would also go 2-for-4 in that game, but any chance of a breakout star rookie of the year season was quickly thwarted as 5 days later, Cerrone broke his thumb on a foul tip in a game against the Tigers. The thumb would cost him 6 weeks, or he'd be sidelined for 6 weeks, but by that time, Ashby and Ernie Witt had become somewhat entrenched behind the plate, so once again, for the third straight season, Cerrone would spend most of his time in AAA, but he did get called back up in August as the two Toronto catchers struggled. He hit his first major league home run in his first start after his recall, which took place on August 17th, 77, against the Texas Rangers' Nelson Briles. He and Ashby would really split time behind the plate for Toronto in 78, both appearing in about 80 games or so. Ashby was the slightly more offensive catcher. Cerrone would hit only .223 that year, but he did begin to establish himself as one of the best throwing catchers in the AL. He threw out 40% of base runners attempting to steal off of him, 33 of 82. And apparently, whether Toronto prized defense or whatever, but Ashby got traded after the 78 season, and Cerrone was the clear starter in 79 and had another strong season behind the plate. By modern metrics, probably not too impressive, only a 0.7 war according to Baseball Reference that year. He had a 652 OPS, but he, at age 25, he caught or appeared in 136 games, had 7 homers and 61 RBIs. So pretty decent counting stats. Again, a burgeoning reputation as a defensive catcher with a strong arm. And again, had a high draft pick pedigree. So Cerrone was young and promising. And also, as mentioned, from the tri-state area. Undoubtedly appealing for a team that just underwent an incredible tragedy and loss. The Yankee organization, of course, was still reeling from Thurman Munson's tragic death. So as soon as the 79 offseason kicked in, one of the Yankees' first moves was to orchestrate a trade with Toronto for Rick Cerrone, along with Tom Underwood and Ted Wilborn, in exchange for Chris Chambliss, Damaso Garcia, and Paul Mirabella. Being from the area, Cerrone was, of course, thrilled by the trade and didn't express any fears about the pressures of replacing the Yankee captain, saying, sure, there'll be pressure, but I'm not going to try to duplicate Munson. I'm not going to try to take his place. I'm just going to be my own man. Whatever his philosophy was, it certainly worked for him, as Rick Cerrone, in his first year in New York, enjoyed what would far and away be his best professional season in 1980. Cerrone would hit .277 that year with 14 home runs, 85 RBIs, in 147 games, good for a 4.2 war, according to Baseball Reference. He threw out a league-leading 51.8% of runners attempting to steal. That overall performance earned him a 7th-place finish in the American League MVP voting that year. 1980 was, of course, the season the Royals finally got over the ALCS hump against the Yankees, but not because of Cerrone, who went 4-for-12 in his first postseason appearance with a home run in the series. So he may have seemed to be on an elevator very much on the way up, but he quickly went from Yankee and Steinbrenner favorite to target, although in true Big Stein fashion, he went back again to favorite once he was gone. Cerrone, there are probably two reasons, as far as I can identify, he struggled in 1981, both in the regular season and in the 81 postseason, performing decently, hitting .333 with a homer in the first ever American League Division Series caused by the strike, but struggled mightily in both the ALCS and the World Series, which the Yankees dropped to the Dodgers. And during that postseason, the feisty Italian Cerrone, as my stepfather surely would have approved of, would not take any guff from his blowhard boss. After a loss in the American League Division Series against the Brewers, Steinbrenner apparently went into the locker room and ripped into the team for showing him up, for not caring, for not playing well, and Cerrone apparently responded by swearing at Steinbrenner, who threatened to get rid of him the following year, and Cerrone responded, what do you know about it? You never played this game. but probably more galling than yelling at Big Stein, who did seem like he could take it. Prior to the season, Cerrone won his arbitration hearing, getting a hefty raise to $440,000 for the 81 season, over the $350,000 the Yankees had offered. And as an aside, at the beginning of the year, I started to read the book Lords of the Realm by John Haler. I'll probably discuss it much more in depth in my next podcast, but you know, I was just inspired to read it because it's this really long, it is a long book, but it reads like a, I don't know, it's a very, very much a page-turner, and it's, if you've never read it, it's pretty incredible history of baseball's labor strife and you know, just some of that stuff from the 70s and the 80s and the dawn of arbitration is fascinating, and stuff that they're still, I don't know, the owners are still grousing about today. It's very fascinating. The arbitration hearings seem to be a real sticking point, and Cerrone's win in arbitration, and particularly his contract that he signed following the 82 season, though he didn't have a great 82 again, he re-upped with the Yankees in the free agent frenzy of after the 1982 season for 4 years and $2.4 million. I was pretty young back then, but my memories of Steinbrenner, he could take you talking back to him, but he would be much less happy if he thought you were overpaid and not living up to that contract. And Cerrone did continue to struggle, particularly offensively, and struggled with a multitude of injuries, as is not unfamiliar for those wearing the tools of ignorance. And while he loved playing in and around his hometown, he began to lose playing time after the, in the 84 season, he was in a timeshare with Butch Weiniger, so he ultimately waived his no-trade clause when asked and got sent from the Yankees to the Atlanta Braves after the 1984 season. This kind of truly began the journeyman phase of Cerrone's career, as he would switch teams 7 times over the next 8 years. He would only spend 2 consecutive years in one organization in 1988-89 with the Red Sox, and in those 7 team switches, he would return to the Yankees 2 times. As again, once Cerrone was gone, Steinbrenner pined after him, just like Billy Martin, only on the playing field. Most of these seasons, Cerrone was a backup, averaging, you know, in the 2 to 4 home run range, 15 to 30 RBIs a season. He had a slightly more impressive 87 back with the Yankees and 89 season with the Red Sox, but perhaps most notably, or at least most entertainingly, in 1987, Rick Cerrone pitched 2 innings for the Yankees, throwing a scoreless inning on 2 separate occasions for a career pitching line of 2 innings pitched, 1 walk, 1 strikeout. I do not know what he featured, and, you know, if he actually had a solid fastball a la Desi Relliford, or, you know, if it was just small sample size luck, but kind of got to love a position player with the 2 scoreless innings on their baseball reference page. That third and final stint with the Yankees ended after the 1990 season. The Yankees released Cerrone in 1991, and he was more than happy to stay local and skip his way across town to the orange and blue. As soon as he cleared waivers, Cerrone, still living in Jersey, noted after signing with the Mets he wanted to play for a contender, and he was hoping to stay close to home. So apparently he expressed to his close friend Lee Mazzilli that he had interest in playing with the Mets. Mazzilli passed this info on to Buddy Harrelson. So the Mets just assumed the responsibility for the major league minimum, which at the time was $100,000, picking up the Cerrone, who had been waived while under contract. Now, at the time, you know, Cerrone was 37. He harbored no thoughts of a starting job. The Mets had a 27-year-old Mackie Sasser, who seemed to be entrenched as the starter, and a defensive whiz of a backup, or purported defensive whiz of a backup, in Charlie O'Brien on the roster as well. Upon signing with the Mets, Cerrone said, "I'm really not here to compete for a starting job. I'm here to help those guys. I've learned you can help a team win even if you're on the bench. So he might have been slated to be a third catcher and veteran presence on the bench. But if you want to talk about making a good first impression on your new team, and yeah, let's be honest, a former Yankee might not get a huge benefit of the doubt in Queens, but Cerrone made his Mets debut with panache and style. In Game 2 of the 1991 season, the 1-0 Mets were trailing the Phillies 1-0 going into the bottom of the ninth at Shea. As if to rub some salt into the wound, former Met Roger McDowell came on to shut down his former team for the save. But with one out, in his very first at-bat as a Met, Cerrone would take the third pitch he'd see from Roger McDowell into the left center field bleachers in Shea Stadium. I was about to say Citi Field. I cannot believe that. It's been around that long. At any rate, Cerrone would tie the game at one. In the bottom of the 10th, Hubie Brooks would come on to make a Met return, a successful return to the Mets of his own, to give the Mets a walk-off win. The Mets would move to 2-0, and it looked like another season of exciting contention on tap in Queens. And here's where you could cue the Ron Howard voiceover. It was not. 1991 would be a terrible year for the Mets in general, but also, in relevance to Rick Cerrone, it would be a terrible year for Mackie Sasser in particular, as that's when the hacker would begin to develop the yips and encounter difficulty throwing the ball back to the pitcher, which really effectively short-circuited and ultimately defined his career. I kind of irrationally loved Mackie Sasser as a kid and enjoyed his slashing, hacking, hitting style, and his bat waggle, but that was just painful to watch him unravel that way in 1991. And unfortunately, Charlie O'Brien was on his way to yet another sub-200 batting average. And as another sidebar, God, did I loathe Charlie O'Brien. You know, no offense to him, I guess, but when he reinvented himself as Greg Maddux's personal catcher and started to hit adequately and for pop, I don't know. I know a lot of players have left the Mets and thrived, or thrived and come to the Mets and then promptly fallen apart. But there was something just particularly galling, because, I mean, a Charlie O'Brien plate appearance is about the worst offensive player I remember, other than Ray Ordonez. Just felt like a hopeless at-bat, and seeing him become not a hopeless at-bat was shocking. But I digress. All this is to say that as the 1991 Mets went 77-84, their first losing season, their first season below second place since 1983, Rick Cerrone at 37 actually went on to play the most games at the position for the Mets in 1991. Actually was, according to Baseball Reference, the team's sixth most valuable player, just behind what will surely be a soon future podcast subject, Jeff Innes. And he was actually the second most valuable position player behind Hojo, with a 1.7 BWAR for the Mets in 1991. He'd only hit one more home run for the Mets, his slash line of 273, 360, 357 gave him a 717 OPS, a 104 OPS plus for the Mets. It was actually the only season besides that 1980 season where he was above 100 in OPS plus. The Mets leaned on him a lot in June and July, as they were kind of still trying to hold on to contention, and obviously faltered as both of the younger catchers struggled. But the workload probably wore him down as he faded a bit down the stretch. And as the Mets were clearly not going to contend in 91, his playing time dwindled, and the team tried to get the younger O'Brien untracked. Cerrone made his last appearance as a Met on October 5th, 1991. He pinch hit for O'Brien, grounded out, making the last out of a 1-0 loss to the Phillies in the penultimate game of the season. It was a game in which Terry Mulholland outdueled Anthony Young, who fell to 2-5 on the season. but looked like a promising young pitcher. Unfortunately, as bad as 91 was for the Mets, 1992 would be even tougher for both the team and for AY. O'Brien would catch the final game of the season, which you all may know as the absurdly overplayed Mets Classic David Cone 19 strikeout game. I liked David Cone as a Met, and 19 strikeouts is pretty impressive, but I don't know why I have to watch that on endless loop on Mets Classics to relive, again, the first disappointing Mets season, or the most disappointing Mets season in that 83 to 84 to 91 range. It's absurd how often that is on SNY. But once more, I digress. Cerrone would play one more not quite full season in 1992, ending his career kind of where it began, in Canada. Well, I guess it began in Cleveland, but at any rate, Cerrone became the 21st major leaguer at the time to play for both Canadian big league clubs by suiting up for Les Expos in 1992. Darren Fletcher was slated to be the Expos' everyday catcher, but he went down to injury. So the Expos in 92 for quite a while featured two 38-year-old catchers, Cerrone and another former Met, Gary Carter, who had returned to Montreal for a swan song with his original franchise that season. Cerrone hit his final career home run on April 21st, 1992 against the Pirates. He had his final, I guess you would say, big offensive day of his career against the Mets and against Anthony Young on June 8th, 1992. He went 3-for-4 with two doubles and two RBIs, as Young, who had started the year 2-0, dropped to 2-4. Yes, that was game four, I believe, of his 27 consecutive losing decisions. Actually, in the game, Young was the only thing that kept the Mets from being no-hit by Ken Hill, though, as his infield single was the only Met hit of the game. Very appropriate, as many of those 27 consecutive losses were really not Young's fault, as those 92-93 teams were atrocious. But as for Cerrone, his playing time would dwindle, Fletcher would come back, and of course, Gary Carter, got the bulk of the backup time. After that June 8th game, he would record only two more career hits. He would go 0 for his last 14 at bats over June and July, leading to his release. I would imagine that 0 for 14 would really have to hurt, as Cerrone ended his career with 998 career major league hits, falling painfully short of the 1,000-hit club. For his career, Cerrone hit 59 career home runs. He hit 245 for his career with a 301 on base, 343 slugging, for a 644 OPS. His career WAR, according to Baseball Reference, was 8.1, but again, a pretty robust 1.7 with the Mets. And I know I already kind of gave you most of his numbers for his one full Met season. I found it very amusing, since his name was mentioned several times, when you scroll down to Cerrone's career similarity scores, the second most similar batter to him in his career was Alan Ashby. So it's no wonder Toronto had a hard time deciding between Cerrone and Ashby when they were both on the roster. A few notable other similar players were Jerry Grody, Butch Weiniger, Mike Scioscia, and Joe Girardi, insofar as Cerrone comps. But there was no comp for that Newark, New Jersey attitude and panache and style. Cerrone also had a notable, interesting off-the-field career, both during his career and afterwards. Immediately after his career, he served as an analyst on Yankee broadcasts in 96 and 97, and then for the Orioles in 1998. During his career in 1981, he recorded a single entitled A Long Home Run. I have not listened to it yet, but I think I will as soon as I'm done recording this. He did it and donated any royalties to a victims fund for an Italian earthquake in 1981. And he actually founded the independent Newark Bears franchise in the Independent League, and sold the team in 2003. As mentioned earlier, Cerrone went to Seton Hall, and he was actually the first baseball player to have his number retired by the Pirates. Four others have gone on to have the honor: Craig Biggio, Jason Grilli, Mo Vaughn, and John Valentin followed Cerrone in that honor. In his retirement, he has lived in and around Jersey in Teaneck, Montclair, and Woodland Park. And at last report, continues to live in Jersey, or split his time between Jersey and Florida, where his three daughters live. Definitely, reluctantly, more remembered as a Yankee, but again, someone I know that my stepfather particularly liked, and who put in a solid season with the New York Mets. And for that, Rick Cerrone, unforgettable. Thank you for taking the time to listen to Unformettable. Please go to amazonavenue.com for more Mets-related content. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can find this and all of our amazing pods wherever you get your podcasts. Original music by Bunga. I'm on Twitter at WolfRR, WOLFFRR, and the show is at Unformettable. Thank you, and as always, let's go Mets.